from the Bardic College. Early editions of D&D, especially Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st and 2nd edition, included a monster rarity in the monster stat block. Encounter tables in those editions placed monsters in encounter tables based on their rarity. Unique entities were often listed as very rare or unique, and some encounter tables abused math quite a bit by putting things like demon lords and archdevils in those very rare slots. If you couldn't see, I put quotation marks around very rare. That means that deep gnomes would use the same slot on those charts as Demogorgon. You know, the ape guy with the tentacles? Let me tell you, one of those is a much nastier surprise than the other, and unless it's a horde of those deep gnomes with their pickaxes, I'm guessing it's Demogorgon that's the nastier surprise. Unless, of course, you really like tentacles. I'm not judging you here.
And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D keeps coming up on the random encounter charts. Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew. I've been running the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast, since 2017, and in 2021, I became head gnome. And in stating that, I just realized that I have been writing for Gnome Stew for 10 years now.
There's no 2014 should not be 10 years ago. That's just wrong.
Yeah, that's just wrong. I don't like this. I want time to stop or slow down just a little.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and I've been gaming since roughly 1985. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs. After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about coming up with compelling encounters for your game. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, my campaign journal, I have entered a D&D drought. I haven't even been able to play Baldur's Gate 3 in the last 2 weeks. This does not mean I'm not gaming. Quite the contrary. I had a gaming weekend recently where I ran Vaesen and got to play 3 different Mutants and Masterminds games where I got to play Magic, an Elseworlds Wonder Woman, and Artemis from Young Justice. It was absolutely glorious. But it is very likely that Cygnus de Guerre is going to join City of Cowls on hiatus. We're going to play our next session, but after that, we're probably going to put the game on the back burner. Some nonsense about the GM getting married in June. I joke, I'm actually one of his groom's people, so I totally get it, and we actually had to convince him that he's probably not going to be able to put the energy into running the game he likes to do. So it was like, let's run the next session, which is a continuation of our last session, and then we'll put it on pause until after all of the wedding shenanigans sometimes in July. Now, when Jared and I say we are polygamerous, we mean it. I love D&D, but I also love many other games. And because of these two hiatuses, we are going to be playing things other than D&D. I'm going to be running a Savage Worlds Superheroes campaign for the replacement of Cygnus de Guerre. TJ is percolating with something that will probably also be Savage Worlds, but could be something else completely different. We don't know yet. We'll see when we get there.
But I think you may still have a D&D game then.
Oh, I totally still have a D&D game, but that's not the one I get to talk about.
So I also had no D&D since our last episode. But in the interim, I've been kind of getting things ready for my Curse of Strahd game that's going to be monthly on like the first or second Saturday of the month. Because all of my players are pretty new either to D&D or to D&D 5e. I wanted to give them like a bunch of choices, but I also didn't want to overwhelm them. I've been trying to kind of look at a list of some of the species that don't have subraces, because I kind of want them just to be able to look at a thing and understand what it is without going, oh, and there's a second part you have to pick too. But I also know they know a lot of the iconic fantasy species, so they don't necessarily, yeah, I don't necessarily want to take something away from them if they really want to play a dwarf and then drill in and become a hill dwarf or whatever that means. I do have a feeling though, knowing them and some of the things that I have asked them about, I think they're going to be very interested in some of the weirder characters, which should be really interesting in Curse of Strahd. So in between the time I started planning this and now, one of my players was like, I got on D&D Beyond and made an account, and I've been looking at tieflings. So I have a feeling I know what direction she's going to be going. I did try and come up with a document where I summarize, I kind of give a pitch for each class, even though they've been playing the pre-gens that I handed out to them. I do kind of want, since they're picking this class and they're going to be playing it for maybe 10 levels or whatever, I kind of wanted to give them a pitch on, this is what this thing does across the board, not just, you know, the first three levels of play. Backgrounds are going to be a little bit trickier to make iconic, because backgrounds could be so cool, but they're basically just an afterthought. It's just an excuse to tack on a few more skills and a language or things like that.
You could do some stuff to make them more important iconic for the characters, but that is a conscious choice you have to make and then work on.
What's interesting to me is this is where the fact that both Tales of the Valiant and the 2024 rules are moving towards adding a feat to backgrounds. On one hand, I get that that makes them more mechanically important, but on the other hand, I now have to explain that to my players, that you may want to go through and see what kind of feat you want at first level and then reverse engineer your background from that, which I kind of don't love a whole lot.
I think with newer players, I would probably just give them a list of the backgrounds and have them be choose which one suits you, and then most of them will hopefully have an interesting feat that will fit with the character, and let them do the metagaming and the min-maxing later.
Yeah.
I mean, if one of them comes to you in a couple of levels and go, man, I really wish I had that feat instead of this feat, maybe then you can negotiate a change, but I would just give them the backgrounds and let them choose based on that.
I think what I really want out of this is, if they were to go and play in somebody else's game, they wouldn't be thrown off, you know, by whoever's running it doing something, as long as they're running a fairly standard game of D&D. So they understand the game, and I didn't, like, you know, leave them hanging by not showing them something. Or the other thing is, if one of them decided to start running for their group of people and they wanted to be the DM, I would absolutely love that. And in that case, I want them to be prepared and have a good, solid grasp of the game as well. So there's some interesting goals involved here. I do have some friends, and, you know, I think we even did this a little bit in some of our games, where they'll try and have a scene or two at the end of a session zero. I don't tend to like that, and I think it's because my brain gets very locked on one thing, and in session zero, my brain is locked on, we are setting things up. We are building a framework from which I will build things in the future, but not actively today.
One of the things you could do that isn't necessarily having a scene is, when you have the characters establish relationships with each other, encourage them to be a little more descriptive, a little, maybe not narrative with that, but basically dive into the story of why these two characters have this connection. That could give them enough of the spark that they start connecting with the game and the characters, without it having to be a full-blown scene where you're trying to get all of the characters in it and together and ready to do something. And because I know that's exhausting, you know, when you're trying to do a session zero and get everyone on the same page. And honestly, most of the time when I've done a session zero, they've got the basics of their character filled out, but they don't necessarily have all the bits and details in place.
Depending on the game, I usually have like a minimum, I need to know all of this stuff by the time we end. There are other things that you can fine tune, but I need to know this list of things. And it varies by game. Sometimes it varies by campaign, but it's like, by the time we leave this session zero, we have not been productive unless we have established these things. And I know that sounds more like work than fun, but at the game store, I've had too many times where I tried to run a session zero and people thought it was just BS time and they just talked about stuff all session. And I'm trying to tell them, no, I need you to come up with this stuff. And then it was basically session zero by email, and they would still come to session one not fully built. And it would drive me just up a wall.
There's a reason you're not regularly running at the game store anymore, even beyond COVID.
It's really funny, because running online has made me realize things like, while I do like running face to face, it has made me realize that there are so many distractions at the game store and so many things that actually drew energy from me that I would rather have had for running the game. The very last thing that I really wanted to keep in mind for this, though, is Curse of Strahd sort of kind of assumes that you start off in the Forgotten Realms and then you wander into the house and then that's your transition into Ravenloft. And I don't really want to teach them anything about the realms because you don't stay there for more than, you know, the introduction. So what I think I'm going to do is, like, when we start talking about, like, gods and, you know, if they have clerics or anything like that, I'm still going to default to that Dawn War pantheon that is in the DMG, because that's what we've been using for this campaign.
I think that's a reasonable choice.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
So moving on into our Dungeon Master's Workshop, we wanted to take a look at how to produce the best encounters in your game. How do you design the encounters you want to be an important part of your game? How do you come up with encounters that fill the spaces between what you have planned and what you haven't planned? And before we do that, we wanted to look at the way the various editions of D&D have defined what the word encounter means.
So I'm going to start off by talking about the BX, the Basic Expert Edition box sets, and it's pretty much the same in Beck Me as well. Before I say this, keep this in mind for the first couple of these that we talk about. Earlier in the game, monster was used as a term for any NPC. It wasn't just an aggressive NPC trying to kill you or something that was non-humanoid. So keep that in mind when we read these first few definitions. So in BX, a meeting between a player character and monsters is called an encounter. That's it. That's the definition.
In Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, the definition is: chance meetings are known as encounters with wandering monsters. Finding a creature where it has been placed by the referee is usually referred to as a set encounter.
Yeah, that almost sounds romantic when you read the way that's chance meetings.
Chance meeting under the moonlight. Star-crossed lovers. There's only one bed.
The AD&D 2nd edition definition gets a little long-winded, which actually kind of makes perfect sense for 2nd edition.
That was what 2nd edition was.
So here's the 2nd edition definition. An encounter is best defined by two broad criteria. If the described event lacks either of these, it isn't a true encounter. It may be a described scene, an event, or a bit of mundane business, but it is not a role-playing encounter. First, an encounter must involve a thing, an event, NPCs, characters or monsters, or a DM-controlled player character. A meeting of two player characters handled by the players alone is not an encounter. Your players are talking to each other, even if they're in characters, not an encounter. It is an action between the players themselves, not an encounter. Second, an encounter must present the possibility of a meaningful change in a player character's abilities, possessions, or knowledge, depending upon the player's decisions. The key here are meaningful change and player decision.
God, they got wordy in 2nd edition.
I'm glad they gave us that really succinct definition there.
Moving on into the 2000s, we get to D&D 3rd edition. As interesting as it is to talk about adventures and the stories behind them, the game is really composed of encounters. Each individual encounter is like its own game, with a beginning, a middle, an end, and victory conditions to determine a winner and a loser.
Which gets into some of 3rd edition's issues, because I wouldn't necessarily say trying to convince a merchant to start selling you stuff is something with a winner or a loser. It's almost like, okay, we've convinced him to let us buy magic users now, that loser.
Yeah.
He has to take our gold now. I think that one would have been better served saying that there is a measurable objective that you can see whether or not you achieved, which is different than a winner and a loser. So 4th edition had this to say about encounters. Encounters are the exciting part of the D&D game. They have tension and urgency about them and a chance of failure. They involve lots of die rolling, often in the form of attack rolls and strategic thinking. They give almost every kind of player something to enjoy. The rules of the game are most important in encounters. The rules are all about determining whether you succeed or fail at the tasks you attempt, and thus whether you successfully complete the encounter.
I mean, that's a pretty good description.
Yeah, and it kind of frames it as it's an encounter if you had to engage the rules rather than just talking, which I think is fair.
But 4th edition wasn't good enough, and we had to come to 5th edition, and here's the way 5th edition defines it. Encounters are the individual scenes in the larger story of your adventure. Period. Thanks, 5th edition.
Take that, 2nd edition.
So, not all of those descriptions actually match our experiences, and the 5e description is really, really short. I mean, like, it's like 2nd edition took all of the words, and so 5th edition didn't have an economy of words that they could use, so it's just one short sentence. So, what is your definition of an encounter in a D&D game?
If you pull together little bits of 2nd and 4th, it kind of makes sense. I think it is something where there is some kind of choices being made. Like, it's not just saying, hi. I do think two people talking in characters can be an encounter, even without rolling dice. But, you know, there's kind of a point to that, you know, to what you're doing in that encounter. I think it is probably, you know, kind of like we were saying when we were talking about 4th edition, if you're engaging the rules, it's probably an encounter more than just a scene.
Right. I think encounters need to have a degree of challenge or risk about them. And I think this could be swung into any direction, whether it's the combat encounter that most people suspect, or it could be some social encounter where there is something the PCs can gain by engaging with certain NPCs.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that the encounters are the connective tissue of the larger story and narrative being told in the game.
I kind of think it's the difference between active and passive. If you're role-playing with other NPCs, that is great. It's wonderful. You're building bonds. That is part of the game, but that is the more passive part of the game.
Right.
If, on the other hand, you're talking to someone you've never talked to before and you're trying to make them a contact and there's some level of risk and somebody with a good charisma score is probably the one you want talking to them and you're going to roll for it, that is an encounter because there is something more going on there that you need the rules of the game to measure.
Right. So since we have defined it that way, do encounters always need to be focused on combat? What kind of encounters can we do that engage with different styles of play?
This is one of those things where it's very sad that 4th edition got off track in the way it presented some skill challenges early on, because I really do like the concept of skill challenges.
Yes.
I like the idea that there are multiple things that you need to do in this encounter to be successful. And it is not about combat. It is about using your skills and thinking about, you know, the right way to do things and which skills to use, maybe what spells to use. I definitely think that, you know, the other tiers, you know, when we talk about the pillars of D&D, you have, you know, combat, exploration, role-playing, all of those pillars can have encounters in them. And actually, I think you're much better off if you make sure that you do have all of those pillars in your game.
I do believe that combat encounters are, they're the bread and butter. They're the bedrock that the game is kind of built on. But if all you ever give your players are combat encounters, it can get real boring. Mixing it up and having a social scene where the characters truly need to get something out of this scene and having that be something they're engaging with. No, there may not be as many roles in that social encounter, but that's still an encounter. And then, like you said, the skill encounters, the skill challenges. The idea of them was one of the best things in 4th edition. The implementation was not quite the best. They ended up coming across a little boring, but I do love the idea of them. I've tried to implement them in my own games in a variety of different ways, and it's usually like, here is the scene, you tell me what skill you're using, and I have in the back of my brain a certain number of successes that the group as a whole needs to get to before they can succeed at defeating the skill challenge.
Yeah, and this is also a place I want to bring up. If you have never noticed in the skills section in 5th edition, group skill challenges are awesome. I love them, and I throw them at my players on a fairly regular basis. And all that is everyone in the party has to make a skill check. If half the party or more is successful, then they succeed at whatever it is that is challenging the group. And I usually use this to give some kind of some way to adjudicate travel, so that travel isn't just completely, you know, drawing the line between the two dots on the map. And we can actually say that, you know, in between here, there's a storm that blows up because you all didn't manage to, you know, batten down the hatches and help the crew get the ship to sail away from the edge of the storm or something.
Yeah. The historical idea of the party being unable to sneak anywhere because they have the clumsy fighter in plate mail. It's like, okay, yeah, there is some truth to that guy is not going to be sneaky, but having every single character have to roll their own individual stealth roll, this is supposed to be a group working together. You can have them helping each other through a situation to get everyone into a place, and doing a group challenge rather than having each person rely on their own skill roll.
Yeah.
Is going to be climbing a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Climbing a mountain. You know, I can't talk about the number of times in old style D&D where it's like, okay, everyone needs to climb this cliffside. And, you know, my strength 8 wizard is like, well, shit. That's not the type of thing that people do on their own.
Yeah.
Unless they are on their own. This is a type of thing that people help each other. You know, you have the person who can get up there with the rope, and they rig the rope, and then they help everyone up. And this is more of a group skill challenge than a everyone roll your climb check, or in fifth edition, it would be an athletics roll.
Yes. Actually, I think that was one of our earliest encounters in this game that I'm running now, is you guys traveling up a mountain because the stairs had been destroyed.
Yeah.
Part of that, it wasn't you fail the climb check or the athletics check, so you don't get to move further up the mountain. It was, okay, if the group didn't, you know, meet the threshold, then the people that failed on that check, you know, lose their place and slide a little bit and might take 2d6 points of damage from bouncing down. And you now have to make another group skill check to keep moving up the mountain. But the odds are, with it being a group check, you're not going to just keep having people fail. Eventually, you're going to get up to the top there.
Yeah, and I do think, going back to the idea of the social encounters, those fall in a slightly gray area as far as encounters go, but I do think a GM should be giving as much thought to them as they do to the combat encounters and the skill challenges, because those are where the true connective tissue of the story is going to be, is when they're engaging with the NPCs and the story of the game. Thought should be given to how those are set up, as well as, you know, instead of just being like, yeah, you go to the tavern and the bartender tells you about the thing you need to go do.
Yeah.
Put a little more juice in it, man.
This is one place where I do think some third-party publishers have put a little bit more work into some of the areas that maybe need a little bit more mechanical reinforcement, because the Middle Earth 5th edition adaptation that Cubicle 7 did, which is now being done by Free League. Anyway, they have a thing called an audience in there, and basically one person introduces your group. That person isn't like making your request of that NPC. They're not saying, hey, we need you to help us do this. They're just saying, this is who we are. We're glad to be here. And that person sets what the DC is going to be to convince that person that they're making the introduction to is at. And then everybody else makes their, you know, their group check to see how well they make an impression on this person. And then you have somebody come along at the end to say, and that's why we need X. And for every person that failed during that group check, the difficulty might be, you know, might go up one. But like, if somebody says something that NPC really likes, if they succeed and, you know, say something that they really like, it might lower by two. By that time, you have your final DC, and then the last person walks up and says, and this is why we needed to do whatever. And the way the audience rules are set up is just making it, they'll maybe help you out, you know, at a very base level. If you beat it by 5, they will throw this into it too. You know, if you fail by more than 5, they're going to kick you out of, you know, their domain and you will not be welcome here again unless you somehow make amends. And I like that granularity that they added to that.
Do you make a distinction between the encounters in the story and the scenes that serve as the climax of the adventure? Is there a difference between the two of those?
I think there's a difference, but I don't know how to really express it. Because to me, encounters are, they're kind of the struts on which the adventure structure sits. And you use the same mechanics to do, say, your final fight with, you know, whatever the villain of the adventure or the campaign is. But that feels different than just an encounter. An encounter feels like you could take it or leave it, but it has stakes.
I think you could just treat it as normal and go on with your life. But if you want to have a real impact in the game, you need to give a little bit of special treatment to the quote unquote boss fight.
Yeah.
If you look at video games, there's a lot of talk about the video games that nail the final boss fight and those that bumble it. Having a bad final encounter, a bad boss fight, so to speak, can really kind of dampen things. And this can be very tricky to nail down. A new GM coming at this might overplan the final encounter or that big boss fight and end up turning it into a slog. So you have to be careful, you have to figure out how to adapt, but you definitely want to put some special thought into that finale, because this is supposed to be the cool end of the story, and like, nobody wants your middle scenes to be the better, more exciting adventures, and the end scenes to be disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, the more I think about it, from the way it's built, it is still built like an encounter. So I kind of don't want to say that it isn't an encounter. And I know, like, the AD&D definition talked about, you know, random encounters versus set encounters. This would obviously be a set encounter if you're using that definition. There's almost something else you need to put on there saying, like, this is a very important encounter that has to have additional stakes and connections, even though it starts with the same building blocks as a normal encounter.
I'm going to say that you should have multiple of these in your campaign.
Mm-hmm.
There shouldn't be just one boss fight. There shouldn't be one finale type fight. You should be having big, exciting, important fights that are a little more special than the other things you've done throughout the campaign. This can help players understand the importance of defeating a certain character and just give more weight to the campaign, I guess.
So we're talking about these big climatic encounters that are like the linchpin of the storylines that you're playing through or the narrative that you're creating with your players. But can you do that with something that isn't combat? Because we naturally think of boss fights, but can you do something that has enough tension that feels like an important point in the campaign is being reached by this thing that is not combat related?
I think you can. I think you have to be careful with it, because let's be honest, there's a certain expectation in D&D that I'm going to be able to pick up my D20 and punch evil in the face, or stab evil in the face, or blast it with a magic missile. There's just the certain expectation that combat is going to happen. And you can do other things, but you're going to need to make sure they have enough narrative weight that they still feel as satisfying as being able to take down the big bad.
Yeah.
I will say it is a really cool idea to combine things.
Yeah.
Have something start off as a social encounter and then the big bad shows up and you have to defeat them, while also there's this device that you need to dismantle in the middle of the fight. You can combine all of that stuff to have it be, you know, like, mash it all together and just have this really exciting encounter that is all of these things put together.
I tried to have a few of the, and two of them that jump out at me in our campaign that we're playing. So I will be glad to get your input on air. but one of them was when all of you were on trial. It may not be quite as major as fighting a big monster, but it was an important point in the campaign where it was serious. There's important NPCs involved. And, you know, we did that. Basically, I used a modified version of those audience rules that I was talking about earlier to resolve that one. However, like you said, I think because it's D&D, you always have to imagine that there's a plaque sitting off to the side that says violence is always an option. If someone had decided, screw this, I'm going to go strangle the judge, it may seem stranger if you're playing, say, a modern game where people worry about laws and things like that. But in D&D, there is a certain expectation that adventurers maybe aren't above the law, but they can bend the crap out of it.
I thought that encounter worked really well. My only frustration with it is Kizina doesn't have charisma.
Yeah.
It's one of those issues that, I mean, this is endemic to role-playing in general. When you are playing a character who is not good at certain things and you're involved in a scene that has a lot of those things, especially when other players may not be as proactive as you would be if you had those skills. So that's one of those things that I struggled with a little bit in that scene.
Yeah, yeah. And I tried to, like, give some leeway for other skills to be able to sway the judges. But yeah, you're right. And one of the things that's very interesting about D&D is even though they give you multiple skills with which you can do things like deception or persuasion, they all key off charisma.
Yep.
Like, there's no, like, because I'm not good at charisma, I can use this form of social interaction that will work better for me. You just don't do social interaction. You know, it is kind of a dead end.
One of the scenes I did like was the when we were in Valhalla and we kind of had to tell our story.
Yes.
To basically get our rewards from that scene. And like everyone else was hemming and hawing. And I'm like, somebody just do something. And finally, I was like, Kazina's going to get up and she's going to start telling the story. But because charisma is her dump stat, she's not good at telling her story. So she's going to start performing her story. She's going to start acting it out with the acrobatics and all of that, which let me roll a dex-based skill to kind of get across the point she was trying to tell the audience in that scene.
Also, as soon as you were talking about, like, acting out a scene and it's in Valhalla, I start picturing the beginning of Ragnarok when Thor comes back to Asgard for the first time. The other encounter, though, that I would say was not a combat encounter, but still involved violence somehow, was getting rid of the Orb of Dragonkind. You're still trying to break a thing, but it's not fighting back, but it could kill you anyway because of the shockwaves coming off of It. That was almost more of a puzzle in that case, you know?
Yeah, that was kind of like a skill challenge, but the skills we were using were Marin's violence skills.
I'm going to break this really hard.
Do you use random encounters in your game? And if you do, why?
I do whenever I need there to be some consequences for not feeling like something is urgent. For example, I think rolling an encounter every hour when someone's in a dungeon, and this is the key, letting your players know that every hour you're going to be rolling for an encounter, it makes it more of a decision. Do we want to take a short rest?
Right.
It's an hour. The odds are probably with us, but something could still happen if we aren't moving forward.
I have never done it for a dungeon. I tend to be a little too obsessive about the ecology of the dungeons I put together. So yes, I know there may be certain monsters wandering around, but I don't have anything random encounter set up. It's just something in the back of my mind I'm keeping there that, okay, they could run into this. Where I tend to use it is overland travel. I find that doing the overland travel and having the potential for random encounters, I don't know, it helps make the world feel more lived in.
Mm-hmm.
In the Depths of Zendrick game, they're traveling through the jungles of Zendrick. There's stuff out there, you know? So yeah. It's like there's going to be a chance to run into things along the way. obviously I have my things that are, again, set encounters that they're going to encounter along the way, but I also want to have things in place where you just ran into this. You ran into the Treant running away from its... Actually, that was an interesting random encounter because all I had was they run into a Treant that's angry. Of course, the character who was up and awake when they ran into it was the druid, so he immediately started talking to it. And I'm like, oh, well, why is this Treant moving? And all of a sudden, the Treant's home had been invaded by these demons, and he didn't know what to do because he had to leave, and his friends are there, and he needs help. So all of a sudden, this random encounter turned from, it's a Treant they could fight, to it's a couple of demons that took over the Treant swamp that they need help to clean out. It's random encounters, man.
And of course, we did this a little backwards, because I did want to throw out what 5e says about random encounters, because it does actually give you some advice on it. First off, there is a default number and way to determine random encounters, and that is an 18 through 20 on a d20 is when a random encounter is triggered. What I tend to do myself is every hour that someone doesn't run into something, unless it's just like a really sparse area, I increase that by one each hour. So eventually you're going to run into something. If you're there 20 hours, you will run into something, you know, in addition to, you know, whatever else is going on there. But there is a, you know, technically 18 to 20 is an encounter in fifth edition. If you want to use it or not, that's what it is. They also list some reasons for using random encounters. So I thought it'd be interesting to see if we agree with these. So in the fifth edition DMG, it says you should use a random encounter to create urgency, establish atmosphere, drain resources, provide assistance, add interest, or reinforce campaign themes.
I'm kind of down with all of those.
Yeah, I think the only thing that I would say is 5th edition is weird when it comes to draining resources, because it feels like 3rd edition really wanted you to keep throwing things at people so that they had to keep using resources and everything. And 5th edition people are a little more resilient. I don't know. It feels more like I want to do that through creating urgency. I may not want to do that through random encounters, but I might. You know, I'm not completely disagreeing with it.
I do know that with 5th edition, I found 3 chained encounters before a long rest was usually enough to tap them out of, you know, most of their spells or special abilities. I did that with the Depths of Zendrick game during their ocean travel when they found the pirates. They had rounded up the survivors of a crashed ship, mm-hmm. And had taken their children and their treasure. And so the PCs see what's happening on the island. They arrive to help the refugees. They deal with that. They find out the children have been kidnapped. They immediately leave from there and go to where the children were taken, which is a nearby small island. They have a fight on the island with some big crabs, which were really fun to throw at them. And then they have to go into the cave where the children are and the leaders of this pirate group. By the time they got to that fight with the leaders, oh, they were so tapped out. They were so tapped out. I don't think they had a single heal spell left among them. And I think the only reason the druid survived is he turned himself into a horse, which has the most hit points of the animals he could turn into at the time. And basically, it was a fun chain of encounters, mm-hmm. but it definitely tapped them out. Anything more than that, and I think they would have started to have gotten very gun-shy about continuing forward.
What's really interesting to me, too, is when I looked at this and it says provide assistance, at first I was thinking, random encounter for that? Then I realized I actually do usually throw something neutral onto those charts, and if people want to talk to that neutral thing that they've encountered, they might get something useful from it. Like, I've thrown merchants onto things, or even creatures that are willing to share something if the PCs are nice to them. Without consciously saying, oh, I'm going to put this on here to provide assistance, I have put those encounters in my random encounter tables.
Random encounters don't always need to be combat. Mm-hmm. They can be other things. In the Depths of Zendrick game, a couple of the random encounters I had in there were finding a grove of flowers that put you to sleep. And, you know, they had to make their saving throws to not get caught up in those flowers drawing them into sleep until they slept until they died. Or, like, the Treant. Okay, that was supposed to be a combat encounter, but, I mean, I don't want my players to be murder hobos, so if they decide to talk to something rather than immediately fighting it, then okay. You know, I needed to think on the fly with that one and give them something more interesting to do. Like, why is this Treant wandering here? Because Treants probably don't wander. So let's figure something out.
The other thing I really wanted to touch on, though, is if you're making your random encounter charts and thinking of what you want to put on them, that reinforced campaign themes is actually really important, because like you said, when you're doing that Depths of Zendrick thing, you don't want to roll a random encounter and have a white dragon fly out of nowhere in a hot, sticky jungle. Like, you really need to think about, like, what is going to fit with the story that I'm telling right now at this point in the campaign.
It was a black dragon.
That makes much more sense.
Yeah, I thought about a green dragon, but that was a little too on the nose, so it ended up being a black dragon. What is important to keep in mind about random encounters to make them work?
So the first thing I wanted to bring up, not because it's the best advice ever, but I found this really funny. In the third edition DMG, they specifically mention that it is bad form to TPK a party with a random encounter. No real hard guidelines other than just saying it's bad form to TPK a party with a random encounter.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I don't disagree with that. It depends on the style of game you're playing. If you are playing an old school style game, then okay, maybe that's what happens. But in general, I don't want the characters in my games to die. I am a softy GM. I am a cream puff. But if a character is going to die, I want it to be meaningful. I want it to be on an encounter that means something. So having it be because they ran into a giant boar that's made of lightning randomly in the forest, I don't want that to be somebody's death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess it could reinforce the campaign themes of it's dangerous out there, man. But at the same time, I don't want that.
When you're talking about campaign themes, that's actually a good point, because I would worry less about killing people with a random encounter if the campaign is really about exploring. There's not like a greater goal. You're not in that jungle to do something else. You are in that jungle to map out every hex of it that you're moving through. In that case, that's part of the story. Like, we're in a dangerous place and the dangerous place might kill us. That's kind of reinforcing a campaign theme. So I could see it there, but I understand what you're saying about, you know, just a regular encounter too. And I think if you really want to get something useful out of what the third edition DMG says, I think you could extrapolate this to mean, you know, when you're looking at how they define, encounters in the fifth edition encounter building rules and you get into deadly, you probably shouldn't have a random encounter in that deadly zone.
Yeah, that's a good point. This is, of course, always going to depend upon the group of players at your table, because, you know, I can throw deadly encounters at my regular Saturday players all the time, and they will chew through them like they're Doritos. But the kids' game, when I was running for them, I mean, even a medium encounter was sometime touch and go with them.
And I will admit, I think if you do communicate to someone that this isn't just a deadly encounter, this is a you will not win this encounter, you can actually throw those things on there to help tell a story too of, hey, this is an extremely dangerous place we're in. Maybe we need to be careful.
Yeah, I do think it's the hey, there might be a Gnome Stew episode coming up about unwinnable fights. But I do think you can put these in your game, but you need to telegraph to the players that this is not a fight they can win.
Yeah.
Because I have been in those situations where this is what the GM is trying to do and the players aren't getting it, and therefore they throw themselves into the meat grinder and you end up with a TPK.
It was interesting because I know a lot of times people shy away from using modern things to describe things when they're talking to their players in D&D. But one of the things that I found was really useful when I ran Storm King's Thunder for one of my groups to reinforce that Cloth, the ancient red dragon that is like a fixture in the northern, forgotten realms, that he is not someone they could deal with. you know, as far as trying to take him in combat, I specifically explained what he was as large as in the real world. And I'm like, he is bigger than the Statue of Liberty. Whatever you're picturing for a large creature, this is a kaiju. This is on the lower end of Godzilla here.
We talk about this in the Gnomecast episode, but I think it is okay to tell your players, you look at this thing and you don't know that you can take it.
Mm-hmm.
You trust the competency of the characters and let them know when they know they're outclassed.
Yeah.
This doesn't have to be the GM hammering them or railroading or anything like that, but you can phrase it in such a way that you tell the players, you're not so sure about this one. I say this as a GM who hates when my players turtle, because like I just told you, I'm a cream puff, and when my players are afraid to engage with an encounter, I'm sitting there going, who do you think I am? You know, I mean, what do you think I'm throwing at you? Do you think I would actually throw something at you that's going to kill you? No, man, I'm a cream puff.
The other thing I was going to say is Kobold Press is really good at this in a lot of the products that I have seen. But when you're making random encounter charts, I know for several editions, a lot of those random encounter charts say something like 5 hobgoblins, 2 troglodytes. What Kobold Press has done in a lot of their products that I really like is it will say a firegeist trying to burn down the forest. They put some action into what the creature is doing so that it is not just, here is a thing that is standing in the middle of the road, do something with it.
This goes back to me talking about, you know, I spend too much time thinking about the ecology of my dungeons. Why is this creature here? Yes, you want some random encounters, but why are they there? What are they doing? What is the situation that is in front of your players?
Yeah.
It shouldn't just be, you know, I mean, yes, it could totally be a wandering patrol of 5 hobgoblins.
Mm-hmm.
But why? What are they patrolling?
Yeah, and I think that's the important thing. If you're making a random encounter table, I would come up with creature, action, motivation for action.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way you really need to do it to get the most out of random encounters.
Yeah. So in the first edition AD&D definition, it mentions set encounters and random encounters. But what about the in-between? What about an encounter you need to improvise when your players go left because you expected them to go right and you need to come up with something on the fly? Is that a random encounter or is that a set encounter?
It's really funny because, like, that is a I pulled this out of somewhere encounter. Yeah. And, you know, honestly, you can just say there is nothing over here and direct them back onto the path where you have things planned. But I do tend to like to at least have something at the place where they went, even if it's off the trail.
Right.
I do think you can use that same logic that I was saying with the, you know, with the random encounters. And that is, okay, they went to this place. This place is known for this organization or this type of creature or whatever. So I'm going to have them encounter creature doing something because of something else. And at least then you kind of have that idea that they're going to meet someone. They'll have at least a semi-meaningful interaction. But I also think the purpose of that encounter is to let them know this isn't where you need to be.
I don't want to dive too deeply into this because the quantum ogre is a whole other topic unto itself. But just to sum it up shortly, the quantum ogre is a controversial technique or thing in RPGs that some players will say is absolutely bad. And some people will be like, well, I don't know. It depends. The idea is that, like, okay, to the right, you have an ogre encounter, but the players go left. Okay, now the ogre encounter is to the left. The problem with this that you need to be careful of is if the players specifically go left to avoid the danger they think is to the right, you can't just suddenly put the danger now in front of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if there was, like, it's just a whim that they went left instead of right, okay, you can totally move the encounter to where you need it to be. But if they are specifically trying to avoid something that you have hinted at, you can't just shift it.
To a certain extent, just providing the illusion that their choices have meaning will eventually bite you in the rear end.
Yeah.
Because people will start to pick up on that.
I was once running an Eberron campaign, and I had come up with the idea of an encounter where they would find a cult worshipping a dragon, and they had some prisoners that they were about to sacrifice. To kind of set this up, I'm like, yeah, the route you were taking is flooded, so your guide is saying you need to go this way instead of that. And they argued with me for about 30 minutes about why they could still go over the flooded route. And I'm like, guys, it's flooded. Just go the other direction. Well, we don't want to. We can fly. We could do this. We could do that. We could make a boat. And I'm just like, the encounter is that way, guys. Oh, okay. We'll go that way now. You want to give your players choice, but you also need to respect the work you've done for the game, because it's really, really frustrating to have set up a set of interesting encounters and then have your players just avoid it, because the means you set up to get them there aren't, I don't know, they're being stubborn, they're being argumentative, they're just, they're being a pain in the butt, whatever, but...
Here are choices A, B, and C. I will take D, other.
I mean... you've played with players, you know what they do.
Uh-huh.
That whole chain of encounters turned out to be really, really good, because they got to where the dragon cult was. They saw the people about to be sacrificed. They're like, well, okay, let's make this a now problem. And they jumped in and they defeated the lead cultist and all of that, and freed the prisoners and set off about their way. And then the next day, as they're out of the jungles and crossing open fields, well, that's when the dragon comes for them, because it killed their pet. And that turned out to be a really fantastic fight. But it, you know, it's like sometimes you've got to nudge them in the direction you need them to go.
I do think if you create that encounter that people run into because they went off the map, if you're in the right mental headspace for this, it might be good to think, if there's going to be stakes for this encounter, at the bare minimum, that encounter is going to point them back at the direction they should be going. But if you want to create stakes, you could have that person at this other location know enough to warn them, hey, between you and your objective, there is X that you didn't know about before. And you now know that because you engaged me and talked to me a little bit more than just waving at me and walking on by.
What are some reasons you need to change up an encounter on the fly? What are some examples from your games?
One thing that, you know, I can think of is, it's bad form to TPK your party with a random encounter. So, yeah, there are times when I have decided that instead of having average hit points, a monster actually has the minimum hit points that it would have because the PCs haven't hit it yet and they're in bad shape. So, yeah, that's a case where I have adjusted hit points down. I don't try and completely hand wave things, but I do try and walk through things like, this is a rough fight, and also this thing is just hungry. So if they get this thing bloodied, if they do 50% of its hit points, it's just going to say, this is too much trouble for a meal, and it's going to wander off.
Yeah.
So I've done a lot of that kind of stuff, you know, when it comes to emergent encounters. I have also, from time to time, when players get really arrogant and do extremely stupid things, and again, I don't think it's bad form to TPK a party if they bring it on themselves. That may be an extreme reaction. I'm just saying they chose this in that case. But when they're being a little bit arrogant, a little too full of themselves, I have had additional encounters show up in the middle of that because their fight was making noises. And hey, look, the T-Rex just decided to wander into your camp because you're fighting something, and it wonders if there's a meal there, too.
I have done the thing where as I said, my regular players in my Saturday group are tactical, efficient, and good players. I sometimes create encounters that they're going to breeze through. And while I don't want to take away their ability to occasionally just wipe the floor with something, there are times where I want things to be a little bit more of a challenge. So there are times where either some monster gets a few more hit points or a few more minions show up and, you know, add to the encounter, just because, okay, I want this to have a little more meat than, you know, than I did. Now, this is to say there are times where I have had my players completely wipe out a boss monster, well, a pseudo boss monster, in 3 turns. There was the clay golem in the Eberron game, where they had enough time, they knew it was locked in this laboratory in the bottom of the school, or the library of Zalargo, and they had enough time to look up, okay, what are golems vulnerable to? Do we have any of that material? Okay, let's make sure everyone has blunt, they made sure they were prepared. They took a half an hour, they made sure they were prepared. They opened the door, the monk ran in, did a flurry of blows, the cavalier ran in, hit it with a sword, and then the gunslinger went and critted and did 85 points of damage in one hit. This was Pathfinder, but did 85 points of damage in one hit and killed the clay golem outright. And my players are sitting around the table cheering and excited, and there was a little part of my brain going, okay, is there another one hiding behind the shelf? Nope, nope. Even the players who didn't get to go are excited. We're just going to let this one stand.
Third edition and Pathfinder, by extension, were rough because you could see the extremes. You could see your extremely dangerous boss monster, by virtue of initiative and bad dice rolls, going down without ever doing anything meaningful whatsoever. On the other hand, you could have a flesh golem that has a scythe, which does x4 critical, manage to crit 2 players in a row. I've seen both of those.
Prior to the clay golem, there was the incident where they found a minotaur leading a bunch of bugbears. And again, the gunslinger, those gunslinger crits. They walked up, they were trying to negotiate. The minotaur wasn't having any of it. And the gunslinger basically pulled out his gun and shot the minotaur square in the forehead with enough damage to kill it outright. I described the bugbear standing behind it now with brain matter on their face, all putting down their weapons and going, what do you guys need?
One other thing I've done in fifth edition is there are times when there are creatures that kind of make sense as like sub bosses. Like, this is an important thing that is guarding this thing, and it may end up being a legendary monster. But just because of the way things are playing out and the momentum, I don't want that to use its legendary actions. So I have nerfed a thing that has legendary actions before to not use their legendary actions, because it really isn't meant to be the big boss. It's just kind of a guardian of a certain area.
Yeah. As a GM, you need to be on your feet. You need to be proactive and on your feet and kind of watching how encounters are going and understanding when you need to dial it up or dial it down. And this isn't saying make it easy for your players. It's just understand when they're starting to get frustrated or when they're starting to get bored, and just know when you need to tweak things a little bit to make them more interesting. This is something that is a learned skill. If you are playing with your friends, which I hope you are, this is something you can let them know. Hey, you know, we're figuring this out. I'm learning as we go. You know, tweak it as you go. So what are some ways to spice up encounters to make sure your players stay engaged? You know, hoping to avoid that frustration or burnout or boredom we just talked about.
I think especially if you're going to talk about what we were talking about is like, you know, set encounters or plot critical encounters, I think building in things like reinforcements showing up at a certain mm-hmm. time is a good way, because you know, they might be starting, you know, they took down the boss monster's 2 bodyguards, and this is going to be a cakewalk, and now 6 more things run into the room. I think that's a good way to keep it as an emergent encounter that, you know, that keeps moving. The other one, again, I'll let you tell me how you felt about this, but I actually really love lair actions.
Uh-huh.
I think those are great for starting the round off with something new that people have to deal with.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring up lair actions. I think in general, make use of the environment. Think about where this encounter is taking place, what the features are of this location, what your players can take advantage of, what the adversaries can take advantage of. And lair actions are fantastic. I'm not going to remember the name of the book. Jared, what's the name of the book that has lair actions for all levels and stuff like that? Because that is fantastic. I've started using that a lot because it doesn't have to be a boss monster with legendary actions. You could just have, you know, I did this with the Medusa that my players fought in Zendrick. I gave lair actions to her main chamber because that's gonna be cool. And like, honestly, I almost had the statues take out a couple of players, but it made the it made the encounter way more exciting than if it had just been, you know, them fighting and using the statues as cover.
Yeah, the one that we've looked at before is Home Field Advantage, and it's on the DM's Guild, and it basically creates lair actions for a bunch of monsters that don't have them, but some of them are great just to plop into an encounter, even if it's not the monster that they defined it for.
Yeah.
But on top of that, it's okay to realize that an area is important enough that you want it to have lair actions, and you just design things for that lair to do that.
Yeah.
When all of you were fighting the Lich in the vault, I really wanted to reinforce that idea that this is this clockwork place that is completely shifting, that's constantly shifting and moving around. So that vault had lair actions. So the floor would come up and trap somebody underneath. It would open up and just drop a pit. There would be saws that came out of the ground and rolled towards people, so you had to make saves. The funny thing about all of that was I made most of those to be nuisances. Like, the saw wasn't doing, like, murder a player character damage. But what really got me was I got the one where the pit trap opens after someone was making death saves, which means they automatically got another death save because they fell far enough to take damage from a fall.
Yeah.
It did make things a little more exciting.
Another example I can think of is in the City of Cowls campaign. We fought a red dragon in a volcano.
Mm-hmm.
We had to deal with lava, you know, in addition to a huge red dragon that we needed to take out. Pay attention to the environment, use lair actions. You can add skill challenges to this,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially if it's a situation where, you know, you get, you know, one player is keeping the monster at bay while the other characters are figuring out, you know, how to deal with the skill challenge. I put one of these in a one-shot I ran where there was a kind of a living statue golem type thing, but you could slowly disable it by doing certain things on the pillars around the room. Each one you deactivated, you would basically bring its hit points down
mm-hmm.
to the point where it could be dealt with. That was kind of interesting and fun. And, you know, sometimes the players didn't get it and just were like, no, I'm going to keep fighting the monster. And it's like, okay, yeah, but you've got these things to deal with. I'll deal with them after the fight. You know, and then you finally get one person to engage with it. And, oh, they realize, okay, I see what that did now.
Adding objectives that are not just kill a thing is a great thing to keep in mind to put in encounters. Actually, I think it's one of the things that 4th edition also did well, because they did a lot of traps that weren't just, I made a thievery check, so it's no longer functioning. They made a lot of things where it's like, you have to go here and shut this down. Then you have to go here and shut this down. And until you do that, like, a jet of flame will just shoot through the entire build, you know, through the entire room. And you're also fighting imps at the same time. That was kind of a neat trap, because it was kind of this, like, it is a contraption that is trying to kill you, that is not a one skill check and you're done kind of thing.
One other thing I'll say about making your encounters spicy and interesting, make them personal. Like, if your PCs have NPCs that they have fights with, problems with, or an enemy or a rival, having those in the encounter can make things a lot more exciting. I ran a two-table one-shot many years ago with my friend Tristan, where we were each running an adventuring party through different paths of a dungeon that kind of met in the central area. Both groups were after the same artifact, and we had kind of seeded that the leaders of these two groups were estranged brothers, and there were other connections between the two groups. It wasn't like one group was evil and one group was good. It was just they were mercenaries who had been hired to come in here and do a thing. They arrive in the central chamber. It's a blue dragon's lair. The blue dragon rises up out of its lair, and everyone rolls initiative, and they focused on fighting each other and ignored the blue dragon. The blue dragon was literally like, what, am I invisible? because they were too busy fighting each other to focus on the dragon. And Tristan and I are kind of looking at each other. Well, this is a little unexpected. Okay. And because they were so focused on fighting each other, the one character who had like a secondary objective, his character was able to get in, get the artifact, and get out and leave the two groups fighting each other, with the blue dragon slowly picking them off one by one. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that for a campaign, but like making anything personal or relevant to the PCs can just change, you know, it can elevate an encounter so far beyond just a normal murder hobo punch 'em up fight.
I think the last thing I will have to say on this is, if you want to make some encounters interesting, put something obvious and obnoxious on the battle map. And what I mean by that is something that players will want to interact with. And the simplest example I can say is, if you have a big pit or a bonfire, there are times when players don't even care how much damage it does. They want to throw someone in the fire because there is fire there as an ongoing feature of this map. Sometimes this also works if you specifically have a ledge that drops off like 30 or 40 feet on the edge of the battle map. Then people will start thinking, hey, there are rules for shoving people, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, Baldur's Gate 3, it is a joy to shove a monster off a cliff. Although, do not shove near into the lava. You need his head for a quest. That's all I'm going to say. I know so many people have been like, I couldn't complete that quest because I booted Nier into the lava.
But do the NPCs shove you back like they do in Celesta?
Yeah, they do. Like, oh, hey, I lost Shadowheart into the lava. At least I can go back to the camp and have her resurrected. Can't do that in a tabletop game, but there you go. Let's wrap this up and talk about interesting ways to end encounters. Can you have an encounter end on a specific moment?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think there are, like we were saying before, if you put an objective into an encounter, even if there's combat going on top of those objectives, sometimes once you do the objective, it's done. Nobody has a reason to keep fighting. Because it was the anniversary and it was just May 4th not too long ago, it's kind of the Phantom Menace ending. All of the things you are fighting because you finished the objective no longer function. They just stop. You know, you're fighting a bunch of constructs. They just drop to the ground because you finished your objective.
I think you can have, especially for certain encounters you want to have with a narrative impact, you can have them end on certain specific moments. Like you said, you meet the objective, it ends. Or you beat the thing you're fighting and all of a sudden, oh no, there's something else in the distance and it's a cliffhanger. You know, you can have those moments. I will say more often than not with my group, we end up having the encounter running longer than we wanted it to. And, you know, we get to the end of it and okay, we have to call it quits. And then we pick up the next session and like, hey, what were we doing? What did we finish up here? Do we need to deal with treasure from that? Or did we deal with it last night? Or did we deal with it through email? You know, so I think you can have interesting endings to encounters, but never do it in such a way that takes the agency away from your players.
No, but I'm just going to say this. I do like the big monster go boom thing. And what I mean by that is there are certain monsters where it just feels right that when they die, they do something dramatic. I do think you need to kind of telegraph that this is that kind of creature, you know, so that you're not just completely taking your PCs off, you know, off their game by having this happen. But like, there was a whole thing that I used to love in the third edition Hordes of the Abyss book where they had a random table for what happens when a demon dies. There were some great things on that chart, some of which were dangerous. Others were just like, oh my God, what just happened? A swarm of locusts just like blew through here.
I believe when I wrapped up the kids game of Ice Spire Peak, it wasn't written in the rules anywhere, but they basically sliced through that dragon like it was butter. So I had the dragon when they struck the killing blow, it kind of exploded in ice. And so all of them had to like, all of them except the bard who was hiding behind a pillar, had to make a, you know, deck saving throw. And, like, it wasn't going to kill them. It was just like, okay, this fight was way easier than I wanted it to be for an endgame fight. So let me make it a little more exciting.
Yeah.
But, you know, just give it that little bit of extra oomph.
I think those of us that grew up watching 80s era vampire movies, there are some encounter ending things that really emerged from those. For example, you can have a timed ending. If the sun comes up, this guy's screwed, because either he's got to retreat and get back to his coffin, or he goes poof. And that happened a lot of times in these vampire movies, so much so that the very first D&D session that I ever ran, I forced my players to do that. Don't force your players to do it, but there is that thing where you can set a time limit. It's like, we're not trying to win, we're trying to wait out the clock. You know, we're just trying to survive until we get to this certain point. The other thing is because of 80s vampire movies, even if I didn't do damage, I always got as dramatic as possible when I explained how the vampire died, because vampires did not die easy in 80s movies.
No time for rest, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience.
Kobold Press has officially released their Black Flag resource document, which is the core system behind their Tales of the Valiant RPG. This is pretty exciting for anyone who is watching the progress of the game. Now, it's going to be too late for when this episode drops, but they're releasing this because they are about to do a kind of a Kobold Con weekend where they're basically setting up a bunch of games of Tales of the Valiant for people to play or run on a variety of VTTs. It's a purely online con. Basically, it's last weekend. When you're listening to this, it was last weekend. Yeah. So sorry about not knowing about it beforehand.
May 10th, 11th, and 12th.
Yeah, it did get us the resource document released, which is pretty exciting to see. The link to this will be in the show notes, but it's basically bfrd.net.
And also, don't be like the people on the internet that didn't realize that this is like the 5th edition SRD. So when you look at these, each class has one subclass to give you an example of a subclass. This is not every subclass that they're going to have in the Tales of the Valiant book, because this is a reference document. You can play characters just using this, but you're not going to get the entire breadth of the system from this.
Right.
So speaking of things that have to do with obtaining rules, that's a good transition. The D&D Beyond Marketplace has kind of gone through a metamorphosis. It looks a lot different now. I actually think it looks a lot better. They have things organized a little bit different. Like, they have featured and recommended, they have adventures with maps, and by adventures with maps, that doesn't mean there are maps in the adventure. It means that maps function that is kind of like a VTT on D&D Beyond. They have the maps loaded into that, so you can play the adventure using that. They have different sections of the marketplace now that are like partnered content, trending, bestsellers, recommended for new players, recommended for advanced players, dungeon master resources. It looks much better. And on top of that, now, if you've bought any of the bundles in the last year or so that Wizards has been doing the physical plus digital bundles, you don't have to go to Wizards of the Coast site now and then get a code that you bring back and put on D&D Beyond. You can order the physical books straight from D&D Beyond. And if you add the digital access to it, it is discounted. So now you can basically do that bundle straight through D&D Beyond.
No more having to buy things two or three times.
Yeah. So it is much less confusing than going to Wizard's site and then bringing back a code. And it's, yeah, I really like how it looks. However, any time of change brings some confusion and, you know, things of that nature. I could not figure out how to actually do a bundle. And I just recently saw somebody explain it, because there's this little thing, like when you go to order a physical book, it says, add digital for $10 more. And I'm like, oh, that'd be great, but I don't see how to do it. Apparently, if you add digital access to the shopping cart and you already have a physical book in there, it takes the discount off that way. It looks better. but there are still a few unintuitive things going on there. The other thing that's kind of weird is they used to have a function where you could buy just bits of some rule books. Like if you just wanted access to a subclass, you could buy access to that subclass. If you just wanted access to a monster, you could buy access to just that monster. And that has been since D&D Beyond first came online that has been true. They've gotten rid of that now. You cannot do that anymore. What's funny is I've seen a lot of people complain about that. And what I think is funny is I am almost certain Wizards of the Coast did that because they didn't want people complaining about microtransactions. And now there are people complaining because Wizards took their microtransactions away.
I mean, you can't make everyone happy.
No, sometimes you can't make anyone happy.
Yeah, sometimes you just gotta put it out there and the internet's gonna bitch.
Yeah, so it is a time of transition. I think in the long run, though, it makes so much more sense to just be able to order books through there. Now, you can't get the partnered content through there. Like, if you want to get the Tome of Beasts and you can only get digital access, you cannot order. And I understand that because that would be a logistical nightmare to contact a third party people and to keep a amount of their books on hand for you so that you could send them out. I get that they wouldn't want to do that, but you can do it for anything that Wizards of the Coast puts out.
We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast like
Misdirected Mark Plays, Phil, Chris, Bob, and Jerry play and discuss a campaign they've created. Now, instead of just hearing them talk about the theory of gaming and game mastering, you can hear what they do at the table. It's come full circle in their exploratory play series, MM Plays.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.